A year or so ago, I was asked to write the introduction to the new Farrah, Straus, and Giroux edition of The Moviegoer. Now, some of you, maybe most of you, know the story of The Moviegoer and how it fits into Walker Percy's body of work. He'd been writing philosophical essays. He wrote a couple of novels that didn't get published. Then, and I'll circle back to this, he wrote Confessions of a Moviegoer, which found its way to the publisher Alfred Knopf, was radically edited. The title was abbreviated to The Moviegoer. A hyphen was taken out, although it survived on the jacket. And it was published. And Mr. Knopf, who had a personal interest in the firm at that time, had a number of favorites on the list that year, especially The Chateau by William Maxwell, who was the fiction editor of The New Yorker. National Book Award time came around, and Knopf nominated and made a push for The Chateau by William Maxwell. He didn't do a thing for a Moviegoer, but A.J. Liebling was sent the book because he had written a biography of Earl Long, the governor of Louisiana, and was known to have an interest in things pertaining to Louisiana. And he called the book to the attention of his wife, Jean Stafford, and she was on the jury or panel for the National Book Awards that year. So it wasn't formally nominated, but it was considered for the prize. And then the prize day came, and what do you know? The Moviegoer won the prize. And there was a reception, and Mr. Knopf didn't seemed to take any pleasure in the fact that his own firm's book had won, because he had favored a different book by his pal Maxwell, the fiction editor of The New Yorker. So Percy, although a gentleman, felt this lack of support, and either at that reception or sometime shortly afterward, he met Robert Giroux, who had a few years earlier joined Farrah, Straus, and Cudahy, and it became Farrah, Straus, and Giroux. Well, one thing led to another, and Percy went over to Farrah, Straus, and Giroux, and the rest of his books were published with Farrah, Straus, and Giroux. His fiction, The Message in the Bottle, Lost in the Cosmos, posthumous collection of essays and interviews. So everything was all together, except for The Moviegoer, which, not unimportantly, is the biggest seller of them all. So FSG wanted to get the book back, and they worked it and worked it and worked it, and they finally gained the rights. And I don't understand the process fully, but when you want to do a new edition, you have to have new material. And that's one of the reasons why these afterwards and introductions figure into books. This figures into the story of another great Catholic writer, Flannery O'Connor. Her novel, Wiseblood, you know, now considered a classic, sold poorly and went out of print with Harcourt Brace. So FSG wanted to bring it back into print. They needed new material. She wrote a author's note to the new edition, which is a masterpiece of practical self-criticism. It's not 200 words, but it has directed most of traditional understanding of Wiseblood for the subsequent 40 years. This paragraph that she wrote in a day to satisfy the copyright needs of the publisher. Anyway, so now FSG has a need for new material for the new edition of The Moviegoer. Well, as far as I can tell, a big-time novelist was asked and stood aside. And then somebody big in the film industry was asked and stood aside. And this is the cultural pecking order. You know, film, novel, and then the critic is asked. And the critic says yes. So, I got the assignment. And I thought to myself, well, what am I going to do with this? Because one of the things I most keenly came to understand writing The Life You Saved May Be Your Own is the power of the incidental writing by the protagonists. The piece that I just mentioned by Flannery O'Connor. Or, just in the case of Walker Percy, two of the introductions that he wrote are two really consequential pieces for our understanding of Walker Percy. One is his essay about his uncle Will, the the cousin who raised him after his father committed suicide and his mother died in a car accident. That piece, which is central to all the biographies, it's there in his book of posthumous essays, was written in connection with the republication of Uncle Will's book, Lanterns on the Levee. In the same way, Percy's sense of himself as kind of in midstream of Southern writing between the old Southern writers and contemporary writers is best articulated in his piece about John Kennedy Toole in A Confederacy of Dunces. Now, this novel was written by Toole, a gifted eccentric in Louisiana who killed himself, and was brought to Percy by Toole's mother. And Percy didn't think anything was going to come of it, but it turned out to be a really good book. It wound up being published, and Percy wrote a book that, or wrote a piece that framed the novel for the public, and that book won, I think it was either the National Book Award or the Pulitzer Prize. Point is, if you're going to write an introduction or an afterword, don't waste the opportunity. This is not a finger exercise. You've got to really try to do something with it. So I set out and said, what can I do? Thinking in terms of Percy's vocabulary, there are philosophical terms that he kind of half borrowed from Kierkegaard that figure into The Moviegoer and into some of his subsequent philosophical writing. The rotation, the repetition, the vertical search. After all this time, I'm still not altogether sure just what the repetition is or just what the rotation is. Repetition seems to be going back to an old place to see it new and see whether you can recover the old effect or whether it affects you differently. Rotation, you deliberately go into a new space in order to have a new experience. And there's this thing he calls the zone crossing or boundary crossing, where you go into an area where you don't belong, like a neighbor's house where you've not been invited, and usual manners are abandoned and you're able to see each other in a new way. In any case, I thought, what am I going to do, a rotation or a repetition? I'm not really sure, but I definitely had the goal, how can I revisit this novel and Percy and our sense of him so that 60 years on, the sense of its freshness and power is conveyed to people who don't know the biography, who don't know a lot of the history that I've gone through, who don't know Percy's relationship to an old Southern uncle or to Flannery O'Connor or to medicine or to practical philosophy. What can I do? So I did what a writer in this field invariably does, and I looked to Flannery O'Connor. You can't go wrong with Flannery. You know, you can just quote her and you have the her words are better and funnier and more charming than most of ours. So I looked to Flannery to try to think about this novel and how to understand it, see it all over again. Now, O'Connor characterized the literature of the American South in mid-century as a literature set against the typical. In O'Connor's view, there's no typical Southern novel, and that's a good thing. For her, the best Southern novel is atypical, just as life in the South, at least in her time, as she saw it, was atypical of American life as a whole. The atypical Southern novel that she celebrated takes unusual, extreme, even grotesque behavior as its starting point. Such a novel is rooted, she explained, in, and here I get to go into the Southern cadence of Flannery O'Connor, some experience which we are not accustomed to observe every day, or which the ordinary man may never experience in an ordinary life. She always uses the masculine pronoun also. Yet the characters have an inner coherence, if not always a coherence, to their social framework. Their fictional qualities lean away from typical social patterns towards mystery and the unexpected. Aha. So how is it that the moviegoer leans away from the typical towards mystery and the unexpected? Because that's what I think it does. And so, but how exactly does that work? And how did Percy bring it about? Well, first of all, he he leaned away from the atypical Southern novel that O'Connor celebrated. Typically, those novels of the South have something of the heightened quality that is called Gothic. The moviegoer, unlike those novels, becomes atypical through its scrutiny of the typical. It takes ordinary experience, what Binks Bolling calls everydayness, and makes it the subject of fitful philosophical inquiry. It promises a typical moviegoer, anyway the title does, but delivers the inimitable Binks Bolling. It calls literary categories to mind by leaning away from them. It's a Southern novel, but one that makes scant reference to the Civil War, to racial conflict, to old houses and barrel-aged whiskey and the notion of the South as a place where people sit around telling tall tales on front porches, people whose tragic history somehow binds them together. It's a novel of New Orleans. But the protagonist winds up missing Mardi Gras for a stockbroker's convention in Chicago. It's a Catholic novel. The main action concludes on Ash Wednesday. And yet one whose main character considers himself not much of a Catholic at all, but a skeptic whose unbelief, he says, was invincible from the beginning. One who tells us, "I have only to hear the word God and a curtain comes down to my head." The moviegoer is a distinctly American novel, but one that stands apart from the main line of the novel, from Hawthorne to Twain to James and Wharton, and then to Fitzgerald, Hemingway, and Willa Cather. The double helix of innocence at home and innocence abroad. Its key antecedents are the European existentialists Kierkegaard, Sartre, and Camus, the latter two of whom were also important for Ralph Ellison, who drew inspiration from them a decade before Percy, in writing Invisible Man. It's a novel of the search. The pilgrim's search outside the self rather than the guru's search within, Percy liked to say. But without the usual signposting. There's no journey to a strange culture, no savvy guide, no sloughing off of oneself and taking on of another, no raft and river, no feasting or fasting, no new world at the end of the journey. There's just the everydayness of Binks's life in New Orleans and the slight diversion of an overnight train ride. It's a coming-of-age novel, but one whose protagonist is nearly twice the age of Huck Finn and Holden Caulfield. Binks is about to turn 30, an age by which American men of mid-century were expected to have settled into their adult lives. He's a college graduate, a veteran, stock and bond broker, and yet his self is left over, as Percy puts it. Nearing 30, Binks is gripped by the possibility of the search, as if for the first time. All these qualities together, in my encounter with the novel, both here in the neighborhood in the early 90s and a year or so ago as I took it up again to write this afterward, is that the novel is still strange after all these years. Reams of criticism have been written about it. It won the National Book Award. It jump-started the career of an author. It's the foundation, in my reading, for a whole field of the contemporary American novel that's typically written in the present tense, has a sort of disaffected, low-energy protagonist who's submerged in the everyday, and that has that develops toward the briefest and subtlest of epiphanies. I'm thinking in particular of Richard Ford's novel, The Sports Writer, which is expressly modeled on the moviegoer. Moviegoer, sports writer, moviegoer as watcher, sports writer as watcher, Southern average man, so-called, who tends to be intensely philosophical, even so. So there it is, the kind of headwaters of a certain kind of American fiction, and yet itself, it's still a strange book. It's a mysterious book. So Percy, the book wins the prize. He goes to the National Book Award ceremony. And he gives a statement, which as far as I can tell he'd written in advance, that explains what he's up to. And he makes some remarks about the novelist as diagnostician. Percy was a medical doctor and a pathologist studying disease. And he saw himself as a novelist who was diagnosing the sickness of American society, or contemporary society. So he gestures toward that, and he kind of backs away from it. And then, summing up, he says that the novel is a modest restatement of the Judeo-Christian idea that man is more than an organism and environment, more than an integrated personality, more even than a mature and creative individual, as the phrase goes. He is a wayfarer and a pilgrim. That's a powerful and beautiful statement. That, too, has powered a great deal of criticism having to do with Percy, and powered two biographies, and it informs my group portrait, you know, pretty strongly. Writer as pilgrim, contemporary person as pilgrim, narrative as pilgrimage. My book is subtitled American Pilgrimage. You know, we've gotten a lot out of this particular formulation. But reading it, having just reread The Moviegoer, you know, this is last year, I was really struck by the gap between the confident, robust authority of that statement and the much more enigmatic quality of the novel itself. And I went back to the biography then just to think a little bit about this. So, and some of you may know this material, but Percy had trained as a doctor, trained as a pathologist, was working at Bellevue, contracted tuberculosis, went upstate New York and Connecticut to sanatoria, spent, by his own account, a couple of years on his back, unable to do things. It was wartime also. Read a lot of philosophy and European fiction, and kind of got up a novelist. Then he took 10 years trying to sort out how that works. Became a Catholic, married, moved out of New Orleans to the pleasant non-place of Covington, Louisiana. And while he was writing these two novels, what he called A Bad Imitation of Thomas Mann and an Even Worse Imitation of Thomas Wolfe, which is very bad indeed, he was also writing some very good indeed philosophical essays. Because they were published years later in The Message in the Bottle, it's hard to understand just how strong they were, that they preceded his the achievement that, for which we know him, The Moviegoer. They were written in the 50s. They were published in places from Partisan Review to Thought, the Philosophical Quarterly of Fordham. Really, really strong stuff, and material that had the kind of apodictic statements that I just read to you about man as a wayfarer and a pilgrim, and kind of worked them out. What is a particular person riding on a commuter train in New Jersey? What sort of zone is that person in? What does it mean to carve your initials into a picnic table as a statement of your existence, which is a kind of almost like biblical parable-like quality, you know, of that what we're doing with what creative people or expressive people are doing with our lives. We're trying to say, I exist, by carving our initials into that picnic table. So he was working out ideas in these essays, and then, but his sense of what a writer does, and this owed in part to his philosophy and owed in part to his Southern upbringing, was that communication is intersubjective. You don't write for yourself. You write to reach another person, and it takes two to make a truth, and then you dicker over that truth, and you figure something else out. So his philosophical essays were diminished by the lack of an audience. So he turns to fiction. One of his daughters can't hear. I'm not sure how you put that these days, but she was called deaf at the time. So the school where she could be educated anyhow was in New Orleans. So he bought a small house in New Orleans, and he would drive her to school across Lake Pontchartrain, and then he would go to the house near the school for the day and write. So for the first time in his adulthood, he wasn't surrounded by influence and the anxiety of influence. His books were back across the lake. He was in an empty house, him and his protagonist, Binx Bolling. So he's, circumstance and other things kind of push him into this place where he's working in the dark. He's not working from other texts. He doesn't quite know what he's doing. And he comes up with the novel that a strong edit by the film reviewer and editor Stanley Kaufman later is The Moviegoer. So although we've read the novel, or many of us have read the novel in terms of Percy's self-exegesis, that it's a modest restatement of the Judeo-Christian idea that man is much more than an organism and environment, more than an integrated personality, more even than a mature and creative individual, as the phrase goes. Hear the little bit of snark in that, as the phrase goes. Like, he's just so confident what he's done with this novel. Maybe that's the way you can talk after you've won the prize. But what I'm trying to recover is the sense that as he wrote this novel, he wasn't so sure about what he was doing. He was kind of figuring out. He was deep inside the mystery. So here, at this point in my revisiting or return or repetition of The Moviegoer, I think of this distinction that I've gone back to again and again over the years, writing and teaching and talking about writing when I was an editor with FSG. And it's a distinction that Jung made in his really remarkable autobiography, Memories, Dreams, Reflections. And when I turned to it this time a year ago, I realized Memories, Dreams, Reflections was put together in the late 50s at the request of Kurt Wolff, an American publisher. And Jung wrote a few early chapters, and the rest was done in interviews in the late 50s. The point is that Jung, in working out things like the distinction I'm about to present, was working at the very moment that Flannery O'Connor was musing about how Southern fiction leaned away from the typical towards mystery and the unexpected. And when Percy was working in the dark, trying to figure out what this guy, Binx Bolling, was going to do with his life. At the same moment, there was Jung making a distinction between two kinds of psychological novel. There's the psychological novel that's about psychological processes. And I should really look at the book, because I've used this distinction so many times that I may have maybe a bit worn at the edges. But as I recall, that the exemplar of that kind of psychological novelist was Henry James. That he's about psychological processes, which the intelligent novelist is sort of trying to apprehend on the page. And against that, he set the novel that is itself a piece of psychology, like a piece of the author's mind or a piece of the author's psyche, an extruded inner life. And his examples of that, one was Rider Haggard, and I don't know Haggard's work well, and the other, as I recall, was Moby Dick, a novel that is itself a piece of psychology. To me, the reason I found this distinction so useful is because most imaginative work is some combination of the two, and often the matter of making the work what it ought to be is to kind of push it more in one direction or push it more in the other, and to achieve the right balance between one or the other. A totally extruded piece of psychology needs to become a little clearer, or a novel that's overly analytic needs to go into the mystic, you know. Well, in the case of, I'd like to apply this distinction to a distinction that was really important for the Catholic writers of Percy's generation, really, especially Percy and O'Connor, and that's the idea of mystery. There's all sorts of preconciliar uses of the word mystery. Let me just, for efficiency's sake, use the term. O'Connor referred to it as the mystery of our position on earth. That's the mystery that the contemporary novelist with Christian concerns is trying to address. The mystery of our position on earth. Percy, for him it was the mystery of, variously, of human unhappiness, the mystery of our inability to make sense of ourselves, that we can be like Hegel, living outside of the mansion of our own philosophy, that we understand everything about human life except what it means to be born, to be a human being, to live, and to die. The mystery, how can that be? That's the, and why are we so unhappy as a result of that? That's the mystery that preoccupied Percy. So, to go back to the Jung distinction, so I think the novels that I'm suspecting interest people in this room are in varying degrees novels that are about mystery and novels that are mysterious. And I want to just take a quick jog through the work of these two writers so we can try to define what I mean a little bit better. For me, Flannery O'Connor's short fiction is mysterious. It's not really about, it's about people doing weird stuff in the South, but it's very mysterious. Wiseblood is about the mystery of how a person can reject his way to God, but it remains mysterious. It has these odd skips and gaps that were detected by the editor from the earliest version. Violent Bear It Away, it's mysterious, but it doesn't really add up. I don't think that novel works. And the mystery has to do partly with the fact that it's not an achieved work. But it's also, there's this overdetermined sense in the book that it must be about the mystery of baptism and the mystery of vocation, which is like a heavy hand on the back of poor Tarwater as he tries to do his thing. So Flannery O'Connor's criticism, ostensibly it's about mystery. Her executors even called the book of her criticism Mystery and Manners and took a quote of hers and made it into a formula that has been applied endlessly by people who write about O'Connor. But to me, as much as it's powerfully about mystery, but it's equally or more mysterious. How is it that this person in her early 30s, living in the South, speaks with, from the papal chair, so to speak, about Catholic aesthetics with such confidence, such unsourced authority? I still haven't gotten over the effect of that book the day I bought it in London in 1986. I mean, just how does she know this, and when did she get it, and how do I get just a small piece of that thing that she seems to know so well, even though she died, young? What's going on there? And in a similar way, the letters, there, she's incredibly clear in her explanation of what she's trying to do, but the literary power of the letters is what's so mysterious. This is a person who's dying for much of the time in which these letters were written, and they're just radiant with vitality and life. It's just mysterious. So moving on to Percy. So I think The Moviegoer, which is about mystery, how do we figure out what we're supposed to do with our lives? Is it possible to really know, or would we just decide because society tells us? But it's really more a mysterious book. Subsequent novels, he gained a level of self-consciousness after he became a National Book Award winner. In some respects, he reverted to the Southern man of letters model that his Uncle Will had occupied in the previous generation. He had tried to escape it with The Moviegoer, and bang, he's brought right back into it, and suddenly he's a spokesman for the South on race and the Southern literary tradition and so forth. So his subsequent novels are, I would say, much more about mystery. The diagnostician is right in there doing the work, and you can kind of watch him do it. That doesn't mean to say they're not quite strong, but they're not essentially mysterious, except odd patches. There's a patch when Will Barrett goes down underground in The Second Coming that I find really strong and strange. And anyone who's read Murakami's Wind-Up Bird Chronicle, someone should write a paper on the parallels between those two novels, where middle-class, everyman characters are trapped underground and forced to figure out what their life above ground is really about. As I said, I find those pre-moviegoer essays, which are about mystery, also quite mysterious. They're just generated out of I don't know what. After that, his essays, again, are quite strong, but they're more, they're not especially mysterious. They're about aspects of our human situation, you know, the plight of the human person in a impersonal world, that kind of thing, with a couple of exceptions. And one is that novel, that piece about Uncle Will that I mentioned, and where he tries to understand why was his uncle, a great achiever of the South, unhappy. And his conclusion is that Will was, he had a thwarted or unanswered religious desire that Percy felt had been fulfilled in his life but had been arrested in his uncle's. And so then that becomes, Will becomes a sort of a type for the modern person who has so many things but doesn't have this thing that that Judeo-Christian tradition really offers. So most of the work really becomes about mystery, and then there's passages where Bloom become mysterious through the work, but the moviegoer, which was originally apart from his other work and that it belonged to this other publisher, is apart from it in that way too. It's essentially mysterious. How exactly? Again, thinking about this novel a year ago, I thought about an account of mystery, literary mystery, given by a novelist a generation younger than Percy, Don DeLillo. He spoke in an amazing interview from 1982 of the qualities of novels that emboldened him to write fiction, and fiction of a particular kind. There's a drive and a daring that go beyond technical invention. I think it's right to call it a life drive, even though these books deal at times very directly with death. No optimism, no pessimism, no homesickness for lost values or for the way fiction used to be written. These books open out onto some larger mystery. The moviegoer, it's Southern, it's Catholic, it's ironic, it's oblique. It doesn't quite add up. What is it about? What has come of Bing's Bolling's search? What has prompted Bing's to settle down with Kate and embrace everydayness with quasi-religious devotion? It's impossible to say, Bing's remarks in the last line of the novel proper. It is impossible to say. And yet, the moviegoer, like its central character, has an inner coherence. Its take on everydayness has the quality of wonder that is the novel's true subject. It opens out onto some larger mystery, one that we, no less than he, are still trying to solve. Thank you.